This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 42nd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am very pleased to have with me Gillian Hayes. Hi.
Hi.
So, do you say Gillian or Jillian?
Gillian.
Gillian Hayes is an assistant professor in informatics at the Bren School of Information and Computer Sciences at UC Irvine. She's director of the Social and Technological Action Research Group, otherwise known as STAR. Dr. Hayes' research interests are in human-computer interaction, ubiquitous computing, associative and educational technologies, and medical informatics. Jillian has a BS in computer science from Vanderbilt, and also math, I guess, computer science and math, and a PhD in computer science from Georgia Tech. So thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So the first question is fairly straightforward, but I don't know the answer myself. What exactly is informatics?
That is a great question. Informatics is actually a really popular term in Europe, and it's gaining some popularity here in the U.S. And the idea is it's meant to encompass a variety of sort of studies around technology. And so it's sort of, you know, pieces of computer science, but also pieces of social science, of the law, economics, all kinds of different things, all around sort of thinking about technology and the impacts on society and how society in turn shapes new computing technologies and so on. So that's the rough idea. It's a slightly shorter version of sort of information and computer science and.
Right. So there are a lot of computer scientists that are practicing informatics these days, I guess.
Yes, I would certainly say so.
And how does the field of informatics relate to security and privacy and surveillance and all the stuff you've been working on?
Right. Well, so it's interesting. I mean, traditional sort of low-level security, the folks that do, you know, new algorithms for encryption and things like that, fit really nicely within computer science. And in fact, here at UCI, our security experts that do that kind of work stay in the computer science department. Here, what we do slightly differently in informatics is more of the higher level, how human beings are involved in that loop. And so looking at things like usable security and privacy and what is the impact of new kinds of technologies or these new algorithms that people are creating on sort of how people do their everyday work. Likewise, in my work, I do a lot of, I'm very interested in record keeping. And so I look at a variety of domains. Obviously, medicine is one place where record keeping is incredibly sensitive as well as prolific. And so looking at sort of what does it mean to have a digital identity within a medical record, what kinds of things can people learn about you if your medical record is compromised, all of those kinds of things. Likewise, I look a lot at sort of the everyday kinds of tracking technologies that people use, the kinds of things that maybe aren't as central to sort of core computer science, things like, you know, how do people feel about their cell phones tracking them? How do they feel about, you know, creating records of all of their financial transactions through online banking and credit cards and ATMs and those kinds of things? And so looking at the surveillance aspects of that, which actually draws in a lot of theory from things like public policy, sociology, psychology, and so on. And then, of course, the law, and looking at kind of how the different countries and their laws impact these kinds of issues as well.
So a bunch of your work seems to focus on building things that normal people and not geeks can use.
Yes.
What role does usability play in that work, especially when it comes to security?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, you know, it's no surprise, really, that people don't understand the sort of underlying workings of data transfer.
Do you think they need to? Do you think they need to?
You know, it's a good question. I think that, you know, people need to understand a little bit. I often use the metaphor of a car. I understand very little about my car, but I have just enough understanding to know that when I hear a certain kind of noise, that means, you know, I better pull over and call AAA immediately. Or if I hear another kind of noise, everything's fine, but maybe I want to get it checked up in the next couple of weeks. I mean, little clues like that you start to learn when you use a technology over an extended period of time, like a car. We're just not at that point yet with computers. And so You know, a lot of the computer is still a very much a black box for a lot of people, and we need to figure out how can we give them those little clues, that ability to sort of understand enough that they can get help or recognize when something really problematic has happened, but not, you know, sort of turn everyone into a computer scientist. That's, you know, unrealistic and probably unnecessary.
Yeah, and maybe impossible.
Exactly.
We have plenty of computer scientists. Thank you. So what do you think is the best work in usability and security? It's kind of an interesting subfield. And, you know, every once in a while, it'll pop into the mainstream, and then it goes back to wherever usability and security people go. But right. What's going on in that subfield now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I've been a great admirer of Jason Hong's work for quite a while now. He does a lot of work in looking at how can people respond to things like phishing attacks, and how can we teach them, you know, what is phishing and what is not, and so on. And I think the thing that's really nice about his work is he really focuses on sort of educational interventions and not necessarily developing new algorithms and new techniques for actually locking down these things, but figuring, you know, no matter what we do, hackers and spammers are going to, you know, find other ways. So what we need to do is figure out the best way to sort of educate people about what they're seeing and help them to be suspicious at the right times and so on. So I think he's doing a lot of interesting work there. Likewise, Keith Edwards, who's at Georgia Tech, actually has been doing some really great work lately on sort of how do people think about their home networks. And this is one place where people really don't understand the security of their home network. Mm-hmm. They may think that, you know, oh, who even cares? You know, I don't have anything that special on here, those kinds of attitudes. And looking at sort of, you know, how do people actually understand their home networks, and comparing that to some degree to how do they understand other kinds of networks in their homes. And by that, I mean things like your AV is essentially a network. Mm-hmm. When you're plugging in all of those different machines and doing all that crazy stuff, and that's something that people have developed some mental models around. So if we can leverage some of the things that we're learning from those kinds of things and then look at them here, that's great.
So it sounds like the stuff that you get excited about is psychosocial in nature.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, obviously new technological, you know, interventions and new ways of securing things is going to be important in the future. We obviously need to do that. But at the same time, we're sort of constantly racing against the folks on the other side of this battle who also have all kinds of new technologies all the time. And so I really think, you know, we need to make sure to keep the human beings in the loop and help them to do the best that they can to make the right decisions and understand sort of the consequences of things.
Mm-hmm. I know that there's some other work that, do you know Ben Schneiderman at Maryland?
Uh-huh.
Ben has done some cool work on user interface stuff, mostly because I conned him into doing an invited talk at Usenix some years ago. And the way Ben is, he actually went and did some new research so that he would have something cool to talk about. It was incredible how much power you get out of just some simple changes to the user interface of security software, in this case.
Absolutely.
Setting stuff up right. So obviously usability must impact the health records field too that you mentioned before.
Right. And that's actually one of the biggest challenges right now in sort of medicine. And you probably hear on the news all of the time, people are really excited about new health IT and, you know, sort of the rhetoric of this is going to save us tons of money.
Yeah,
and
what do you think?
We're all going to be much more efficient.
Will better record keeping actually save healthcare?
You know, I think it will help. there's a couple of big problems. I mean, one, of course, is that healthcare systems are not interoperable in the way that other things are. And I often hear people equate the current state of sort of medical records to sort of word processing in the early 90s, where everyone's racing and they've got their different standards.
Yeah, remember all those function keys at the top of the keyboard and word star?
Exactly. Exactly. So we really need, you know, some standards there and so on. But the other problem is there is a lot of legislation around healthcare records that has come out with, you know, sort of the best intentions and absolutely You know, we want to protect people's health records, but in turn, it's really made things pretty difficult for both patients and clinicians. And so if we overlay the technology on top of these current policies, not only is it a really incredibly complex technical system to sort of be giving permission for every different lab test to be shared and all of these other kinds of things, but it's not going to be able to do all of these things that we think of. You know, we think, oh, once it's in the database, you know, it's accessible everywhere because that's how other kinds of record keeping typically will happen. But in healthcare, there's so many policy issues surrounding those records that paper or electronic, either way, they're going to be locked down in a variety of ways that make things tricky for people.
So I have a kind of a crazy question. That is, do people tend to believe machines or not believe machines?
It's a really good question. There's actually some interesting work being done, for the life of me, I can't remember who right now, but in agents and trying to understand, you know, do people attribute agents that have various different kinds of characteristics, do they believe them essentially?
I'm thinking of more just, you know, well, the computer said, so must be true.
As it turns out, some of the work that I've seen, you know, if the computer is sort of polite and seems trustworthy in its way of dealing with you in terms of responses and so on, people are relatively willing to trust this machine.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so we certainly, you know, anthropomorphize our technology. I mean, this is certainly well known. And this is something I've seen a lot in my work. I've been working on using mobile phones with patients who may not have access to computers. And the mobile phone, for whatever reason, I think because it's small and they can sort of carry it with them, they turn it into this very humanized, friendly thing that's helping them track records about their children or about their elderly parents or whatever.
And, yeah, they love
it. They talk about it with great affection and emotion. And whatever messages the clinicians send to them via these phones, they're received, you know, incredibly openly. They talk about the phone as being this, you know, this great helper in their lives, these kinds of things. So we're certainly, I mean, there's an opportunity there or a challenge, depending on your perspective, because they are taking that so to heart when they're getting the messages that
way. I think that would have some direct implications into healthcare record stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll be right back after this message. Hi, this is Gary McGraw, host of the Reality Check podcast with Gary McGraw. This podcast series is focused on practical questions centered on running large-scale software security initiatives. Reality Check targets experienced leaders working to solve software security problems every day. Reality Check is sponsored by Cigital and syndicated by CSO Magazine. For more, see www.cigital.com/realitycheck. Jim Routh, who is the CSO of KPMG now, and I wrote an article for CSO Magazine about what we call lifestyle hackers, which is generally speaking about 20-somethings avoiding security controls to use the productivity tools that they're used to, like AIM and Twitter and MySpace and stuff like that. And the question is, as technology becomes pervasive, how do we evolve out of thinking about security and privacy, and, you know, how is our thinking changing over time, and is there a generational effect there?
You know, I think that's a great question. I don't know about the generational effect. I mean, people ask about this quite a bit. And the tricky thing about it is what we know is, of course, the younger you are, the more risk-seeking you are, generally. So it's hard to know for sure whether these 20-somethings will sort of grow out of it as they grow older and become more risk-averse, like the rest of us old folks, or if, in fact, this is a huge paradigm shift, and they're always going to be incredibly much more open.
So we just got to wait and find out.
That's my feeling on it. You know, I think different people feel really passionately on different sides of this. I'm just unsure. But what I do think is interesting is looking at how corporate America in general is having to adjust to this sort of Generation Y set of people. They're very different in terms of their feelings about management and about corporate loyalty and things like that.
Right.
And they tend to sort of job hop and it's, you know, what have you done for me lately kind of behavior. To be fair, you know, they've seen the tech crash. They've seen a variety of other things. Now the banking crash. They there's reasons that they're not particularly loyal to corporate America. But what that means is that's pervading their sense of feelings about technology as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then couple that with, you know, sort of the way that these policies tend to evolve. It's just, you know, we're not sure about this, so we're going to say, no, you can't use it. And
right.
that's not a particularly well-reasoned way for companies to say no to things.
That's right. It's a pretty stupid reason, actually. And especially if the 20-somethings think, gosh, I sure could get a lot more done if I were only allowed to use AIM.
Right. Well, and I think you saw the same thing, you know, 10 years ago with, or maybe even a little bit more, with email, where, you know, initially it's like, well, you can only email within the company. And then slowly people start to allow you to email outside. Some places would let you use external email services, some only your work email. But, you know, slowly those things were broken down. Similarly, I think instant messaging followed a sort of path like that. So it may well be that things like Twitter and the, you know, MySpace and Facebook and so on are going to follow a similar path, where once the corporations can start to see some value in it, then perhaps they'll let their guard down a little bit.
Do you think that the 20-somethings are beginning to understand privacy implications of the stuff they're posting on their Facebook and MySpace pages?
You know, I've been very interested in that question, actually, lately. There's certainly no shortage of media coverage of those kinds of things. But when I talk to at least to the students in my classes, you know, and these are sort of folks that in the next 2 years are going to wind up being IT consultants for the most part. This mm-hmm. is the kind of career path most of them take. They largely say, oh, you know, that's just the media. That's, you know, just one thing that doesn't really happen. Or, you know, of course, that person that happens, they're stupid. How could they, you know, think of such a thing? They certainly are recognizing that those things happen, but I'm not sure that they believe that they're very frequent, nor that they'll happen to them. You know, and again, this is not hugely surprising when you sort of think about how, you know, adolescents generally view the world. And it's, oh, yes, people do get in car accidents. And, oh, yes, these things do happen, but not to me.
Not to me, right. Well, that's why they make good soldiers, because they're still immortal until
right.
they get killed. So,
right.
Do you think that surveillance technology will shift that view?
Yeah, so we've recently been, I mean, CCTV is sort of the surveillance technology that's everywhere, right? And we've recently been doing some studies that sort of try to get at how do people even identify that they think CCTV is in an environment, and do they even notice it, and do they remember it? And then if they do believe that there's some sort of video recording of some kind, what does that really mean? You know, is this sort of a continual surveillance kind of situation? Do they think that there's just cameras in the space that are not even turned on, that are just being used as a deterrent?
Are they just paper cameras like the one over your door?
Exactly. So what do they think are going on with these cameras in these spaces? And what we're finding is across all age groups, for the most part, people don't notice cameras at all.
Interesting.
So they're making reasoned decisions on whether they think there ought to be a camera there based on a variety of other factors. They don't actually sort of look around and see if there's a camera in the space, which is a very interesting thing, because it means, you know, that we're so inundated with these kinds of things that instead of, you know, sort of actively noticing a recording technology, they're making decisions based on other factors. You know, is the place so nice that they must be recording because they have stuff that could be stolen? Is it so bad that it's dangerous and scary? These are the kinds of factors that lead in, as opposed to actually recognizing the technologies.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I think that that's sort of interesting is that it very much mimics the way that online surveillance happens, where you don't see someone, you know, scraping your Facebook page. You don't see someone, you know, Google stalking you, all those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
You can't physically observe it. So you have to make decisions based on other sorts of heuristics. And we're just not really great at that as human beings. So I'm really interested in trying to understand how do people sort of detect these kinds of things, and how do they make sense of them?
I think that's really interesting. The 20-somethings, especially, you know, since they're used to using this technology that we've been talking about, seems mm-hmm. like maybe they would develop some better sensibilities about surveillance than maybe our generation has. Who knows?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it'll be really interesting to sort of watch And especially as we start putting out more and more sensors into environments, whether they be sort of simple things like RFID readers and accelerometers or, you know, other kinds of sensors, you know, what is that going to mean for folks? They're intentionally sort of invisible. They're meant to blend into the environment. And will the younger people who've sort of grown up with an idea of mobile technologies and, you know, all kinds of online databases about themselves, will they have a better understanding that these things are sort of all connected? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, that's one of the sort of really interesting research questions moving forward to try to understand, you know, what's going to happen as both the technology changes and, you know, we have a generation of people who've never not had the internet coming up now. And they certainly have a very different idea of what that means to be fully connected.
Yep. So your work in civic engagement is very inspiring. And I'm wondering whether civic engagement needs to be shovel-ready, as in the pictures on the STAR website, or whether interacting with policymakers and leaders counts as well, and whether you're trying to cover that in your civic engagement work.
Right. Well, thank you for saying it's inspiring. That's great. You know, I think the most important thing that we can do as researchers is find real-world problems that maybe we can't solve them today, but we can at least work towards addressing them in the next however long. And it's great that you bring up policymakers, because this is exactly the situation that we're in, where there are things that we can address right away. Certainly, there are technologies we can build to help, you know, various things. We can create some interventions to help teach people, you know, various things, all of those kinds of things. But there's a lot that we run up against some significant issues in policy. I mean, and what we were talking about earlier with sort of medical records and the way that they're protected and not protected in variety of ways is a great example of that. So one of the things that I do certainly try to encourage my students to do and try to do in my own work is think about how does the sort of empirical data that we're gathering about the world and about how people are interacting actually influence things like what we need to be doing, you know, at a meta level, at a policy level. One of the things that we've been thinking about a lot lately is if we were to start trying to teach kids, very young kids, about online security and online privacy, what would that mean? And how can we use some of the research that we've been doing lately, which has uncovered all kinds of holes in people's reasoning about these kinds of systems, to design new kinds of educational policies that might push this kind of instruction into a much younger group of people. Those kinds of things, I think, are really important. You know, we can certainly address some things short term with, you know, new systems and new interventions, but the real power is going to be the things that we do to influence what's happening 2-3 decades from now.
I'm also thinking about, you know, the role that technologists like us have in influencing kind of, what would you say, leadership and national policy, political policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is whether we should invent stuff and sort of leave the rest to the political leaders to sort out, or if we should be more careful about the stuff that we invent. What do you think about that?
Right. Now, I mean, I think, you know, there's certainly, well, human beings have an amazing capacity for taking whatever has been created and turning it into both amazingly wonderful things to help humanity and, you know, very dangerous things, right? This is something that we're incredibly good at. And so I certainly, you know, feel like technologists should be thinking and thoughtful about their new designs and so on, but I also recognize there's nothing that we can do to completely prevent people from appropriating new technologies into all kinds of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, I think it's absolutely true that, you know, technology designers have a responsibility to help the policymakers understand the technology well enough to actually legislate on it. And this is something that I think is a real breakdown where, you know, everyone sort of got their heart in the right place, but if we're not communicating with one another, it may be that policymakers don't even understand the new things that we're developing, and therefore how could they possibly create appropriate legislation?
I can assure you that they don't, in my experience anyway.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's something that we can really do to help. And in fact, we need to do, because when we don't, you know, you see the responses. They often wind up doing more harm than good.
The series of tubes comes to mind. So
exactly.
Back to informatics. Part of informatics, in my view, and you kind of mentioned this before, involves humanizing technology and technologists. And here's a crazy question. How does having more women in computer science help that agenda, or hurt that agenda, or, you know?
You know, it's a funny thing. As it turns out, you know, women are a huge part of the consumer base, and in fact make more sort of consumption decisions, at least according to most of the marketing folks.
Especially when it comes to shoes, yeah.
than the men do. And there's this phrase in the technology world that you've probably heard, which is, you know, shrink it and pink it. And the idea being
I haven't
that,
heard that.
You know, if we just make technology smaller, cuter, and pinker, women will buy it. That's fine. It works to a certain degree. I have a pink mouse. You know, these kinds of things are somewhat true. But fundamentally, you know, we as technologists and designers, you know, we're always going to bring our own perspective into what we create. That's just natural, and that's just human nature. So having more women in the field will just help to bring more of that perspective to all kinds of different things, and so that we're not sort of left with the, you know, the very simple sort of product solution, which is the shrink it and pink it one. Likewise, I find, you know, our program actually, we're very lucky. We're in the informatics department specifically, we have much higher proportion of women than most, you know, sort of computer science departments do. And I think this year we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 30% to 40%, which is really quite incredible.
Is that because it's an informatics department?
I think it is. So the things that, you know, and I can't, of course, prove this in any way, but the things that I hear from our students, you know, are, especially the female students, they want to do things that are meaningful to the world and are impactful, and it's much easier to see the connection between, you know, developing and studying applications that real human beings are going to use as opposed to, you know, developing the latest and greatest compiler or, you know, a new low-level security algorithm. It's much harder for people to make that connection. And so if you're driven by a goal of really helping the world and engaging with the world, then it's much easier to sort of see that connection in more of an informatics department than a traditional computer science department.
Do you know?
Obviously, those connections are still there in a traditional computer science department. They're just not as obvious and sort of open.
Mm-hmm. Do you know of any organizations that are doing good advocacy work in the field for getting women into computer science or banding them together or anything like that?
So we are members of the NCWIT group, which I always forget exactly what it stands for, but I believe it's the National Center for Women in Technology.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a lot of, it's the National Center for Women in Information Technology. And they do a lot of really great stuff. Their website has just a ton of resources on there. Things like how do you start a mentorship program? How do you start a you know, a roadshow program where you go and talk to girls in elementary schools and those kinds of things. And they just have a lot of that, as well as, you know, various meetings to sort of support people, you know, getting together and talking about these issues of how do we increase diversity, and in particular women, but also other kinds of diversity. They're very interested in bringing in more folks from community colleges or tribal colleges or different things like that into technology and computer science. And they've had some really good successes where if you apply some of the things that they've done, they can actually show, you know, evidence of the enrollment numbers going up or satisfaction and retention going up or various different kinds of metrics that you might use.
Hmm.
So I look to them a lot as for resources in terms of thinking about, you know, things that we might do here, both with a younger population as well as with our college students.
Mm-hmm. So the last question is kind of a flyer. This summer I came across a really cool book written by a guy named Harry Mulisch, who's a Dutch guy, called The Discovery of Heaven, and I came across it sort of randomly. What's the best non-geek book that you've read lately?
Oh, that is a good question. I would have to go with Gary Allen Fine's Kittens book. So he's actually a social scientist who goes out and he studies all kinds of different populations, and he did a bunch of research looking at how do professional kitchens work, and it's just fascinating.
Cool. That sounds good.
Yeah. So I love to cook, and I always have had this little fantasy of, you know, opening a restaurant, and then I read this book, and that will never happen, but it's very fascinating.
Stick with computer science, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks for your time. It's been interesting.
thank you. It's been great talking with you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The September-October 2009 issue of IEEE S&P is a special issue on securing DNS. The issue also looks at the NSA's wiretapping behavior under the Warrantless Wiretapping Program. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.